be here. It's humbling to know that there's a need. It's humbling to know that God is still pleased to use His Word for our children, for our youth. And that we may be continue to be pressed by that need. Tonight is, let me just sort of preface my remarks on the topic by telling you what it's not going to be and what it is going to be. I'm not going to be looking at a theological discussion of what a catechism lesson is or is not to be. I'm not going to be looking at a biblical framework or anything for the structure of catechism classes or you know, it's not teacher training course sort of thing. The topic itself grew out of a need that was sort of expressed in our congregation as well, that many of the people who were teaching catechism classes felt somewhat intimidated by the fact that they weren't teachers. And now all of a sudden they're thrust into a teaching situation and they felt at a loss. Where do I start? What am I supposed to do? They remember back perhaps to some of their catechism classes and they recognized that there were some things that were happening that maybe weren't as effective as they should have been. Sometimes no fault of the instructor, but at the same time, they recognized that there was a need for them to think about and to consider how to teach catechism better. My objectives for tonight are to give you something to think consciously about how you're delivering your catechism lessons. It's intended to be fairly practical and fairly straightforward. Secondly, I'd like you to think critically about your own teaching. Okay, so first of all, I want you to think consciously about what you're doing. And why you're doing it. Secondly, think critically about your own teaching. You'll be probably recognizing things tonight that you're going to say, oh, I've been doing that wrong. But there will be a lot of other things that you'll be saying, oh, I'm doing that right. A lot of what you're going to hear tonight perhaps is not going to be earth-shatteringly new to you. A lot of it may be things that are just practical, straightforward, and make some common sense to you. Thirdly, I'm going to be sharing some practical applications for the classroom. And I'm coming from the perspective of an educator. I've only taught about 17 catechism classes in my life. I was a stand-in for our pastor for a year, and a stand-in for whoever who was sick for a while. I've been in education for about 12 and a half years total. And it was from that perspective, plus the fact that in my job as a principal, I work a lot with other teachers as well. And part of my job is to critique lessons and to give them an idea as to how they can improve their classroom work. So a lot of you are going to have a lot more experience than I do. And if we get to questions at the end, if you'd like to add anything to what I say, please feel free to do that. I'd like to ask a question right off the bat to get a bit of an idea as to how you are situated according to catechism lessons. How many of you do teach catechism now or Sunday school? Okay, how many of you have taught in the past? All right. Of those of you who put your hands up, how do you feel in terms of qualified to do so? Yeah. It is intimidating. It is serious. It's a weighty subject. You probably also don't feel completely comfortable. You probably don't feel completely competent. You don't feel in control many times. It's a position of vulnerability, but it's a position of opportunity as well. So as we go through tonight, I'd like to look at three things. Planning your lesson. Secondly, understanding some critical foundations, foundational elements to maintain a learning environment as you're teaching your lesson. And thirdly, We want to make sure, of course, that we engage the mind of our students. Okay, lesson planning. First thing I have to stress is that you have to know your lesson material. You can't get up in front of a class and wing it. We've all been in those situations before where we just haven't had time or opportunity to prepare and we always feel badly afterwards. You have to know your lesson material. I'm going to make a few suggestions. Begin early in the week with reading and prayer. And I would strongly suggest that on the Sunday, you find some time after you've taught your morning lesson to pre-read the material for your coming class. Begin early in the week. Read the selection. Read the biblical passages that go along with it. Consider it prayerfully. Okay, so begin early in the week. Consider it prayerfully. Secondly, as you go through your week, take opportunity from time to time to reread the biblical passages. Read parallel passages which deal with the principles that you'll be discussing. Some of you in the older grades, this is easier because a lot of it is laid out. Are you using the books by Jim Beeke? Okay. So a lot of the texts and the passages which are supporting are in the margins. They're part of the lesson. And you can go back and see what the context of a lot of those passages is and familiarize yourselves with it. Thirdly, ponder its obvious intent. Don't try and get into little nuances and details and everything else. Ponder its obvious intent, and as you go through it prayerfully, ask God to direct your heart and your mind. Now, it's absolutely important that by the time you get to your lesson, you're familiar with that material. You know where it is, you know what it is, and you know what you're going to be doing with it. Okay, so we have to know our lesson material beforehand. Secondly, and I trust you do this too, know your students. Who are they? What do they already know? What lessons have they covered before? Is this going to tie back to something that you've already had? What do they understand about the topic already? What kind of kids are they? Are they eager? Are they intellectual? Are they very interested? Or do you have a couple of kids in that class who may be a little bit distracted? Or maybe mentally lazy. Know who your kids are. Know what their mental characteristics are. Try and get to know what they're capable of and what they're not capable of. As we get down and talk about this a little bit later on, it's critical that you're teaching where your students are. And so it's important to know what they understand and your job is going to be to build on that knowledge already, that's already there. Okay, section C. Next thing you have to do is put some structure to that information, the information that you're going to be presenting to them, and you know what they're like. You want to structure your lesson plan so that you are intersecting their lives with the Word of God. What do I mean by that? We don't want to be learning a bunch of knowledge that we can just sort of comfortably stand beside and say, these are the truths, and be able to stand beside them comfortably and, okay, I know that, and let's leave that alone. Now, this gets more and more critical as you get into the older grades. You want your students not only to know, but you want your students also to recognize that there are implications for their lives in what they know. Okay.
The first thing that you want to do is consider, what are my objectives? Okay? What do I want them to know, and what do I want them to understand? If you don't know what you want your students to know, they'll find it. But will you ever know if they know? You have to know what you want out of them. You want to be specific. Do I want them to be able to know the books of the Old Testament and to be able to recite them? Do I want them to understand something about Joseph's character in the way he showed godly example and be able to explain it back to me? Okay. Notice I'm being more specific than just a general or a vague notion of being able to understand some of God's truths. Okay, so I want to take the lesson material. I want to be specific enough so that I know that my students are going to be able to respond back to me. Secondly, I want to be personal. I don't just want them to know some information. Okay, this is point B yet. Or sorry, objectives. We had a point A. You might be labeling it. I want to be specific. And secondly, I want to be personal. What am I expecting to become part of their spiritual awareness? God's Word is given us for a purpose. It's given us not only that we might know, but that we might live unto Him. And when you strive to teach the children the content, we're also looking for the life lessons. If that was true of Joseph, what does that mean for me? If I think about the way Joseph dealt with his brothers when he rashly told them about his dreams, about how they would bow down to them, and I recognize that the values that Joseph was embracing there were values of pride, what does that mean for me and how I relate to my brothers and sisters? Be personal with them. What am I expected to live as a result of what I know about God's Word? Okay, so when you're planning your lesson, look for those two aspects of objectives. Be specific enough. What do I want them to know? And how am I going to be personal with them? Okay, you've done some planning. You've identified what it is you're after. Now you have to deliver the lesson. When we're in the classroom, we try to make sure that we have a couple of different aspects to our lesson. One of them is the introduction. The second one is the main body of the lesson, which you can see there. And the last part is some sort of summary or evaluation, which you can see there under point three. I'm going to consider that separately. In your introduction, you want to do a couple of things. Somehow catch their interest. Now, you're going to have to remember their age level here. It doesn't just do to say, okay, students, sit down and be quiet because we're going to start. Okay? That's not your introduction. That's just getting them ready for it. Try and engage them. Ask them a question. Do you know who? Lead them into the lesson. Give them a question. What if Jesus were sitting in this classroom today? And then go on and give a hypothetical situation, perhaps. Start out with a little story to catch their attention, or a little anecdote. Something to relate to them and to get them set. The other thing that you want to make sure that you do in your lesson is give them directions for what you're doing and where the lesson is going to be going that day. You know, it's really challenging to get into a class where things just sort of come one thing after another and you have no idea what the big picture is. So it's good to give them the big picture. If you're going to be doing a lesson about Joseph, tell them you're going to be learning about Joseph. If you're taking a couple of different aspects of Joseph's life, lay those out right at the beginning. If you're going to be doing it in a specific way, let them know that too. And that way they're ready for it, they're mentally prepared for it, and you can get into the lesson itself. Okay, so you've introduced the topic. Now you have to get to the lesson itself. When you're planning your lesson, you have to think about how you're going to progress through the lesson material. What am I going to choose? What's going to be first? How am I going to do it? Okay, so what progression am I going to make through the lesson material? What's going to be the order of how I go through? The next thing I'd like you to think about is what activities will I use to get them to know or to get them to understand? You know, this is probably the most efficient way of transmitting information from adults. One person simply going through telling another person and you write it down. But it's not always the most interesting. It's not always the most exciting. And let's face it, we're dealing with kids who've been sitting still for about an hour and a half before that. The other thing is that students don't always remember things that they've just heard. If you can get them engaged in a lesson in different ways, that's valuable too. That's why so many of the younger kids sing a lot of songs. That's why they do hands-on things. That's why teachers use felt boards sometimes and storyboards and show what the characters are doing and go through the story. And the children have a visual contact there. There are a number of things that you can do. Maybe your lesson is going to be in question and answer format. You're going to ask questions, and you're going to see how much they know. And sometimes it's a good thing to keep on asking questions until they just don't know the answers anymore. Because then their minds are open. It's like, I don't know. They're prepared to hear, and they're prepared to take in that information. Sometimes you can give students a worksheet, perhaps, that you've prepared. Sometimes you can play a little game with them, maybe a quiz, one side to the other. Usually you do that for reviewing concepts or something, maybe after a unit or a section that you've done, or promise that one is coming if they know their things well. As you go through and look at it, think about, okay, am I going to get my students involved? Are they going to read specific parts of the lesson if you're using the book? Am I going to read specific parts of the lesson? Am I going to ask questions to link what's in the text with what the proof texts are in the site? So let's go to can't think of something off the top of my head, but if you take, okay, the main explanation, and then you have a text at the side, maybe you want to say, okay, who can explain to me the link between the text and the concept that we've just talked about? Have the students give that back to you. Don't have you be doing all the explanation and all the thinking for them. Plan on keeping them mentally engaged all the way through. I think you should be understanding that there's more than one way of teaching, right? It's not just that you as a teacher have to talk and tell them everything in order to teach. The next point is a humbling one. You're only teaching when students are learning. And if you remember that you're there as a teacher because they need to learn, that's sometimes what keeps teachers being, keeps teachers in their place and keeps us humble too. Sometimes we come out of a lesson and we say, I just don't know if they learned anything. And we have to go back all over again and look at why. What are some of the reasons? Be prepared for that to happen. Don't be discouraged if it does and when it does. Be prepared for it to happen. The other thing I'd like you to remember is that sometimes you'll have everything nicely prepared, all laid out. You know exactly what you want to do, exactly how you're going to do it. You'll get into your classroom and somebody will ask a question. They don't understand something, or they'll ask a question to a real burning issue that comes out of the text, and you might just drop your whole lesson plan and deal with the issue. Don't be afraid to throw away your lesson plan for a teachable moment. That's what we call them as teachers. I can remember once I was teaching a grade 7 class, and the students were agitated when they got to school. They were talking already out on the playground. They had witnessed an accident scene where a car had driven underneath one of those trucks that pick up the vehicles, and somebody had been decapitated, and they had witnessed that it had driven past just after it happened. I had 21 or 22 grade 7 students, about a third or two-thirds of them who had seen this accident result and walked into class with it that morning. Well, nevertheless, my Bible lesson went on the shelf. And my second period lesson, I forget, math or phys ed or something, went on the shelf as well. We spent the whole hour and a half before recess talking about whether or not we would be ready for eternity in the event that God took us away suddenly and tragically. I had every student's attention. I had every student's input. We had a class discussion I'll never forget. And if I had insisted on going ahead with my lesson plan, I doubt if the kids would have remembered one thing about their Bible lesson or one thing about their next class. And there may be times in your classroom too when there may be issues that you need to give them spiritual guidance on that are more important than the lesson that you've prepared for. Be prepared to. I shouldn't say be prepared. You're never prepared for those sorts of things. But be ready to say, Lord, help me. This is something that needs to be dealt with. And then don't be afraid to go ahead with it. Okay. You've figured out how you're going to introduce it. You've figured out what the main part of the lesson is going to be. And now you have to figure out how you're really going to know if they know and if they understand what they've done. The point that I'm making here is you can have a good lesson, good introduction, you can go through all the stuff and just leave it. And how will you ever know whether or not they grasp those concepts? As a teacher, that's crucial. Think of some way to get feedback. Sometimes what I'll do is I'll get to the end of the class and say, okay, we've talked about three things today. The first one was this. Who can summarize that for me? And then you get one student from the class to summarize it back. The second thing was this. Who can summarize that one for me? What was the third thing? Who can summarize that for me? Get their involvement. And you can do that way. You can do a question and answer format. You can do it by asking them to write you a little paragraph. You can do it by asking them to go through their week and think about how the principles of what we discussed today are going to apply to your week. And next week when we come back, let's talk about how you apply the principles of today's lesson to your week. Maybe it was a lesson on jealousy or anger or, and those sorts of things. When you deal with emotions and behaviors, give the kids some homework. Give them something that's going to make that connection between what we talked about in class
and realize. See, that's a form of evaluation as well. You're getting feedback on whether or not they understand the principle. You're also getting feedback on whether or not they recognize that you weren't just telling them so that they know about anger or whatever it might be, but that they can apply those principles to their lives as well. You will have lessons where you'll come out afterwards and you think that went well. You have lessons that you'll come out of afterwards and you say, boy, things just didn't go right. And you'll go back to your drawing board. And that's part of the learning and part of the growing process. There's only one person who taught perfectly, and that was the Lord Jesus Christ. And you remember, I think, that the comment that's made is he taught as one having authority and not as the scribes and the Pharisees. It's a couple of things that come out of there. He taught as one having authority because he was thoroughly familiar, not just with the lesson content, but with how that content had to apply to the lives of his hearers. He taught as one having authority. But he also taught as the, he also didn't teach as the scribes and the Pharisees because they knew all the answers, but they weren't doing it. I heard a comment a little while ago. It says, we've never had a generation that knew so many right answers that's living so many wrong lives. Right? Jesus taught as one having authority and not as the scribes and the Pharisees. Okay. The next section we'd like to look at is foundations for a learning environment. What are some things that you need to keep in mind? First of all, what's absolutely critical is relationship. Your relationship to your students is either going to make it easy for you or is going to make it difficult for you. That's what sometimes makes it such a joy to be a parent and sometimes makes it so difficult to be a parent. You know, if that relationship is good, you can do a lot with your kids. And if we're having a disagreement or an argument or something, it gets really tough. Okay, so relationship is important. First of all, every child should receive your unconditional, respectful, loving acceptance. Let me repeat that. Every child should receive your unconditional, respectful, loving acceptance. That means that no matter what they do, you still have to love them because they are in need of it. You still have to show them respect because the dignity of the human being still requires it. We're still called to love them and accept them in our classrooms. Secondly, you should expect that every student is going to do the same for others. Now, this is just a distillation of the golden rule, isn't it? Teach others as you would want to be taught, or treat others as you would want to be treated. So not only do you show unconditional, respectful, loving acceptance of the person of each child, but you expect the children to show that to each other as well. The next point, I think, is a point of challenge for people who get into the position right away. Some of them try to be the teacher. You might know what I mean. They have this idea of what a teacher is and what a teacher does in their mind, and they try and copy some of the mannerisms, perhaps, and it doesn't always work. Remember, and here's where we come back to that point that I mentioned before, the point about humility. You're there as a teacher because of them, right? Yes, you can take some comfort in the fact that you're given a position of authority. But far more often, in terms of relationship, if they know that you care, they'll care about what you know. Fourth, be interested in them. Hi, Johnny, how are you? I saw you uptown yesterday. Did you buy something for your mom? They have a life, of course, outside of the catechism class. All right, so make sure that you're talking to them about those things. When you see them somewhere else, talk to them. Make those connections continually. Now, that probably happens a lot in a small town like this. It doesn't happen so often, so much in some of the bigger churches and congregations where people might be a lot farther apart. You may see each other more often than just on Sundays. Think about what some of their interests are.
What are they interested in? What are the kinds of things they do? Who are their friends? But don't just think about those things. Think about some of the things that they spend their time with, maybe wrongly.
Because maybe some of those have to be addressed in a class as well. In a sense, what I'm saying again is know your students. Invest your interest in them. Be involved with them when you can. But also be aware of some of the things that are going on in their life. Maybe they have somebody in their family who's sick. Make sure you remember that, because they may be anxious about that. And if you can show that, I've had parents call me sometimes and say, you know, you don't know how important it was that when Jimmy's grandma was sick, you prayed for him in class. And that can be a great comfort for a child to know that not just mom and dad are praying at home, but the teacher also knows, and the teacher is praying in the catechism class. Try and get inside their minds if you can. Watch them as you teach them. See where they are. See what they understand. And the last thing I'd like to have you think about, and this gets important, I think, as kids start to get older. Primary kids are somewhat easy because they're so eager. But as they get older, they get more self-conscious. They get more conscious of things that are going on around them and between them, how they look to others. We'll get into that in a minute. Make sure that the environment in which you're dealing with, it's always safe for them to ask questions. It's safe for them to have a wrong answer. Now, that means when they come back with an answer that's not correct, you have to be careful as to how you receive that. That was a good try, but that's not the answer I'm looking for. Okay, try and give them a positive affirmation for their effort, and then try and get some direction to continue. You don't want a student to go away, I can't answer anything right. You want to try and make sure that students can answer the questions and that they can do them successfully as well. Okay, so relationship is crucial. The other thing that I do want to point out to you, and again, not maybe necessarily as important here, as perhaps in a more urban-type environment, children are spending less and less time in contact with their parents these days. I just read a statistic a little while ago which floored me. It indicated that teenage children spend less than 35 seconds per day in meaningful conversation with a significant adult in their lives. 35 seconds per day. And it just floored me. We're in a position of incredible privilege because I trust that in our homes it's a lot higher than that. But I also know that sometimes as dads we're busy, sometimes as moms we're busy trying to keep going with all the wash and the laundry and the dishes and then keeping the house clean and everything else. And sometimes parts of our lives become routine to interact as well as we should be with our children. Okay. Second point, I'm going to be really quick. Interest. Be interested in your lesson. It should be obvious to them that you care about what you're talking about. It should be obvious to them
that both the lesson and they are important. And that should show through your interest in your material and your interest in them as well. All right. Next point. I want to speak a little bit about routines in a teaching environment. Routines are intended to be just that. Routine, unconscious, unthinking behaviors that students are just expected to do. Unconscious, unthinking behaviors that they're expected to do. Now, what are we talking about? Little things like being polite and saying hello, Mrs. or hello, Mr., you know, as they walk in the door. Responding to greetings. Sitting down, responding politely when questions are asked. Listening carefully. Those sorts of things. Now, sometimes when routines aren't followed, they can make a mess out of a lesson because you spend so much time dealing with the routines that the information that you're trying to convey just gets lost in the shuffle. And this is probably the area that a lot of people say, well, this is the most difficult for me, this whole area of routines. How do I do it? So I'd just like to try and give you a few pointers, a few principles, and I'll try and give you some examples too as we go along. First of all, think about discipline not as punishing a child after something bad has happened, but think about discipline as being the things you do to make sure that bad things don't happen in the first place. Discipline, good discipline, is very, very hard to describe somehow or sometimes because it's almost invisible. We have some teachers in our school who are natural disciplinarians. But the students don't recognize it because they can do it in a warm way, a loving way, which affirms the child. And the routines of the normal school day are just unconsciously carried out. That's what you want to strive for in your class as well. If your kids come barging in and take 5 minutes to settle down, you've just lost 5 minutes of valuable time. Okay, so discipline is prevention. It's not just knowing what to do after something bad happens. The other thing that I'm going to ask you to think about is what routines do you want to make sure that you're obeying in the classroom? And here I would say keep them simple and keep them straightforward. Politeness is going to be one of the keys to the routines. Okay, secondly, before you begin your lesson, get their attention. Wait for it. Make sure that you've got all eyes on you. You might want to say, okay, everybody, eyes to the front. You might want to say good morning and have them respond to you. Wait for it. Insist on everybody's attention. Insist on their being quiet before you begin your lesson. Sometimes a mistake that's made is when students start talking or whatever, the teacher may become louder to try and talk over them. That never works. You ever had it at home where the kids are a little bit noisy and maybe you have some music on, so you turn the music up so you can hear it? What do the kids do? They get noisier. And you turn the music up and they get noisier. It doesn't work. Usually the opposite is better. Become quieter and then they're forced to listen more carefully. The third thing, I mentioned before that routine is supposed to be unconscious, unthinking behavior. When it comes to what you want students to do, try to do it in a positive way. Don't use the word don't. Now you're thinking. Don't use the word don't. Let me tell you what I mean. If I tell a student who's running down the hall, don't run in the hall, what's the mental picture in his mind? Running in the hall. He takes the mental picture and he puts the don't with it.
But the mental picture of running in the hall is still there. If I say instead to the student, go back to the end of the hallway and walk, what's the mental picture that's in his mind? Walking. The other thing is, when I do that in a positive way, I don't give his mind the opportunity to get into the thinking side of the brain. Now, this is maybe getting a little bit technical. And instead, what I'm doing is I'm affirming exactly what I want. Okay? Now, the challenge with behaviors is that we're supposed to be teaching them and not just punishing them. Could you imagine how much math a child would learn if he was doing his math times tables? And you said, Johnny, what's 4 times 8? Johnny said, 31. He said, that's wrong. Go sit in the corner for 10 minutes. Give him a timeout. It doesn't work. What do? You say, no, Johnny, that's not right. What's 4 times 8? You keep on going until he gets the right answer and gives you back 32. And then from time to time, you're going to go back and say, what's 4 times 8? It's 32. What we're trying to do here is the same thing. Positively teach them what you expect of them by having them do it right. Okay? So teach them what you expect of them by having them do it right. So a student maybe gives you a smart aleck answer, right? In this classroom, we answer respectfully. Now, do it again. Okay? Sometimes in teaching, we call them do-overs. And what we're doing is we're giving them the positive guidelines, and we're telling them exactly what we expect from them, and we're giving them opportunity to practice so they can do it right. Does that make sense to you? I think a good example to consider with this is a driving instructor. Driving instructor doesn't get in beside the person who's driving and say, you think it'd be a good idea for you to put your seatbelt on? No, he doesn't. He says, okay, buckle your seatbelt, start the car. Those are expected to be just routine behaviors, and that's why he doesn't spend a lot of time with them. And that's what we're talking about here. If you do something like, Johnny, if you do that one more time, then I will. You know what? You haven't told the child that it's not acceptable for him to do that. You've just told them that if he's willing to accept the consequences of his behavior, then it's okay for him to go ahead and do it. Think about that for a second. So the point I'm making there is when it comes to routine behaviors, tell the child what you expect and give them opportunity to do it and to be successful at it. Okay. Sometimes students interrupt. Then what? Sometimes the best things to do when they do that are to use things that are nonverbal responses. If a student has trouble staying on task or staying focused, maybe it's best that you just walk over to them and be near to them. Okay? Sometimes it's all it takes to get them focused. If they interrupt and you make eye contact with them, then they have an opportunity to engage you. And maybe you're in the middle of something and you don't want that to happen. So somebody over here talks out and you're in the middle of it, it's a whole lot easier to just go like this. They'll get the message. Just a minute, I'm in the middle of something, but I'll get to you in a moment. When you put it this way, most teachers don't, sorry, it isn't students who interrupt lessons quite often, it's the teachers who are interrupting the lessons in response to the student's response, or in response to the student's input. Students sometimes need to be disciplined, if I can say it that way. Usually this means that they haven't been compliant, that they haven't done what you've wanted them to do, that they've been defiant about something. usually in a classroom situation, if you want to try and keep that under control in the classroom, don't send them out, but bring them closer to you. If you're going to send them out, it's because they are so distracting to you and what you're doing to the rest of the class that they're jeopardizing the lesson. Bring them closer. If that doesn't work, tell them that you're going to talk to them afterwards. Sometimes kids will straighten up a whole lot if you say, "Johnny, that's enough. I have to talk to you afterwards." Don't deal with it anymore. Just the threat of having to stay behind. But then you have to follow up on it. And don't forget, because he'll remember that he can get away with it next time if he's careful. Right? When you talk to the student, recognize that when you have a confidential discussion about his behavior, I always say his. Sometimes the girls, or somehow the girls just don't get this, right? When you have a confidential discussion about the behavior, the child recognizes and respects what you're doing. And that's absolutely important. Focus on what improved behavior is going to look like. We get back to the point we made before. Right? Don't just chew him out for what he did wrong, but talk to him about what his improved behavior is going to look like. And sometimes it doesn't hurt. And usually the parents will say, "Oh, I noticed you had a little chat." Sometimes it's better to say, "Yes, we were talking about how he's going to pay closer attention in class." Keep it in the positive. The point that goes along with that is when you have a student who's defiant or not listening or whatever it might be in class, rarely does it work to lecture them in front of the rest of the class. Deal with it privately. Because you have to keep on instructing the student. Remember, instruction is your goal, not to make you come out on top. Right? You can do that by demoralizing a child, but they'll never learn anything as long as they're with you for the rest of the time. Okay. Engaging your students. I want to talk a little bit about the age and the developmental characteristics of children. Some of this will probably come as no surprise to you, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time with it. First of all, primary and junior children. This I'm talking about students up to about grade 6. They're generally eager to learn. They're eager to please their teachers. Their relationship with their teacher is very important. We don't usually have a lot of difficulty with students in that age level. As they get to their intermediate years, as they go kind of from grade 5, 6 up into 7, 8, 9, 10, the idea of relationship is becoming important to them, but it's a relationship that's changing between their relationship to their teacher and their relationship between their peers. That's why you sometimes get so much goofy behavior from kids in that age. They're trying to get the attention of each other. They're not really sure how to do it, so they try all kinds of stuff to see what works. They quite often want to be included in social studies type current events type issues. And sometimes they can be good issues to discuss in a Bible lesson. What's happening in the world around us today? The other thing kids in this age level, they're incredibly concerned with fairness. And that's why it's absolutely crucial for you to be very consistent in the way you deal with them. If you are really lax with them one day and come down hard on them the next day, they'll be all over the place because they won't really know what your expectations are. Secondary students, their self-image is starting to become more important. They're becoming aware of how they look in others' eyes. They're defining who they are in an adult mode and in an adult world. They don't always get that right. Sometimes they say silly things. Sometimes they don't recognize that, you know, the normal boundaries that are there between full adults and themselves at 15 or 16 years of age, and they're learning. Let's help them through. Okay. I'm going to leave the what are their interests. I think we've touched on that already. And the third thing there, actively develop relationship with your students. I think we've touched on that as well. Use of questions in a lesson. Again, what we're talking about here is engaging their minds. Think about different questions other than just being able to straight recall people and places. Ask them about relationship. What's more important, this or that? Why? Get them to rationalize. Get them to give reasons for things. Get them to compare. What are some similarities between these two stories, between these two characters, between these two principles? Ask the contrast. What are some differences? When you ask questions, don't repeat the answers to their questions. Rather, insist that they answer them loudly enough so that everybody else in the class can understand. Remember, they're not just answering them for you. They're answering them so that everybody can learn. You know what happens if you answer, you know, every question and you repeat every answer? The kids are going to tune out one of two people, either you or the other ones in the class. You don't want either one of them to happen. Okay. Sorry, Jim. That wasn't quite loud enough for Julie to hear over there. Could you repeat your answer, please? Thank you. It forces them to stay in touch with what each other are thinking as well. And it also gives you opportunity to have discussions that don't turn into free-for-alls. Third, wait for some answers to questions. Sometimes you ask questions of students and you know, it takes a little while for them to process it. Not for you, because remember, you spent the whole week getting ready for this lesson. But they're just getting it as they go along now. Okay? So give them time to answer. Fourth, try and give every student an opportunity to answer a question positively. So if Jill doesn't get a question right, give her a chance sometime later on in the class to get an answer to a question right. And here again, you want to know what they're capable of. As a teacher, I usually try to make sure that I've got a question for every student during the course of the day. Somebody, that every student gets some interaction at some point. Watch out for your quiet kids. They'll try and slip into the background and not have to be included. Make sure you catch them as well. Finally, show appreciation for their involvement. When they answer a question, thank them for it. When they ask a question, do the same. There's no such thing as a stupid question. And I'd like you to encourage your kids to ask questions, to clarify as well. The only stupid questions are the ones that aren't asked. A lot of times kids think that they're going to look stupid for asking the question, especially when you get into middle grades and upper grades. I don't want to ask that, I'll look dumb. The only dumb questions are the ones that you didn't ask, because then you don't know what the answers were supposed to be to them. And any question that, encourage your students, don't be afraid to ask questions, because you might be the brave one who's asking it, but there might be three or four other people in this class who have that same question, but maybe they're not able to phrase it or to articulate it, to say it the way you can. And I've got a question for you. What do you do when you don't know the answer? What do you do? Thought of turning it back into the class? I'm not sure about that. Do any of you have any ideas? Have any of you read on this? Have any of you thought about this? Has this happened to anybody? Give us some input. See? We're learning together. also don't be afraid to say, you know, I honestly don't know. I've never had to deal with that. I've never considered it. But you know what? I'm going to make a point to find out for next week. But at the same time, how about if all of you guys see what you can find out? Next week, we're going to compare answers when we come back. Keep them involved. Stay with them. Stay on top of them. C, applying the concepts. Use and explore your Bibles together. If they're bringing them to class, get them to look stuff up. Give them homework. Not just in class, that you're going through things together in their Bibles, but give them opportunities, like I just mentioned, to go through their Bibles at home and look things up. Secondly, you have to guide their thinking process. The thing that's difficult here sometimes is that you have to go through it slowly enough so that they can understand. I could probably do this speech about 3 times as fast. But you would have given up writing a long time ago, and you'd probably be looking at me with kind of glazed eyes. Go through, and you can gauge on their response whether they're still with you or not. Okay? If you have an explanation, do it at their level, at their speed. Don't be afraid to say, you know, are you still with me? You understand that concept? Does that make sense to you? When you get to the end of it, you can do something to have it, have them turn around and explain it to each other or explain it back to you. Or to say, who's got an illustration from their life in which that applies? Thirdly, use illustrations from everyday life. You know, it's wonderful that we have a whole legacy of things that have happened in the past that we can go back to, that we can draw from. And God's Word is very clear about some of those things that happened to the nation of Israel. But we have to make sure that we don't forget to make the connections for the future. Otherwise, you know what's going to happen? Our students are going to get the idea that religion was something for an age long ago. Share things of God's grace, of God's providence in your life, where the hand of God was clearly seen. I know I shared once with my grade 7 students an incident that happened to me. We were talking about pride, and I mentioned to them that pride often comes before a fall. And I told them, for me, it happened literally. I used to cycle. I used to race when I was a teenager. I did a lot of training. I'd go 30 or 40 or 50 miles at night after supper. And after God changed my heart, that's one of the first things that all of a sudden became unimportant to me. I thought, it's not going to matter anymore if I never ride again. That was an idol for me. You know, I was planning a trip where the students were going to be taking a bike ride. And in order to do that, we took my bike out and I cycled it. I thought, okay, I'm just going to take my time. You know what? Some guy raced past me. And I looked at him as he went past and I thought, no, Mark, that part of your life behind you. And I watched him. I thought, there were very few people I couldn't catch. I wonder if I can still catch him. No, Mark, that part of your life is behind you. That idol is dead. I lost the argument. I caught him. And I passed him. And not 200 meters down the road, a corner came up around a tree that I never saw. I caught my pedal. I went over at about 35 kilometers an hour. I ended up in the hospital. And my students had a real-life link to today, that God still intervenes when we knowingly go against what He requires from us. All sorts of things have happened in your lives, I'm sure, that you can share with them in various instances. Spurgeon often said, using an illustration is like opening a window that can put sunlight into, or shed light upon it. Concept. The thing that you've got to make sure that you don't do is to turn your lesson into a greenhouse. Five, attempts to specifically apply every principle that you deal with? These are real life things. And finally, 6, pray. Pray with them. Pray for them. Pray simply. Pray specifically. Pray humbly. Don't be afraid to ask them, is there anybody special we should be praying for? Sometimes, you know, the candor and the openness and the honesty of kids will surprise you. Okay, so as you work through, you're striving for whole student growth, which you see as the last point there. You're striving for their intellectual growth. You're striving for their spiritual growth. You're working with their understanding, and you're praying that the Spirit is going to guide their heart. Now, let's stop and think about all that. You're going, wow, that's absolutely overwhelming. Where do I start? What do I do? How can I? Am I really fit for this? I asked you a few questions at the beginning. Maybe those questions are even more burning now than they were beforehand. I want you to think about Moses. You go back to Exodus 3 and 4. God called Moses, and he brought before him a task. Turn in your Bibles to Exodus 3 a moment. Verse 11 and 12. Moses said unto God, who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children out of Egypt? What was his answer? Certainly, I will be with thee. He's got another question in verse 13. Basically, what Moses is asking is, who have I to say has sent me? God's response, I am that I am. The Lord Jehovah. I who always is, I who am now, I who always will be, I'm unchangeable. I am with you. You can say that I, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, am going with you. Turn to chapter 4. Moses said unto the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, not good with words, neither heretofore, nor since thou hast spoken unto thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. I can't do this. I can't talk well. What is God's response? He says, Moses, haven't I made your mouth? Can't I give you the words? See, the thing is, if we stay focused on who we are and what our inadequacies are, we've missed the picture. When Pastor Niels opened with Psalm 78, the reminder there was that this isn't somebody's work. This isn't somebody's ideas. This is God's requirement. This is God's mandate that we teach our children. And yes, we're incapable of doing those tasks. God knows that. And God knows that everything that we lack, He can provide. God doesn't call the qualified. God gives the qualifications to those whom He calls, just like He did with Moses. Moses thought he had all the qualifications when he was 40 years old and he slew that man in the desert and buried him in the sand. He didn't understand how that the children of Israel weren't ready to go out of Egypt with him. We read that in the New Testament. God got him to the point where he wasn't capable, and that made him dependent upon God. It's God's work that we need, and He's asking us to go forward and to do it. It's not our work, it's His, and He will be faithful.
We have to look to Him. We have to trust in Him. We have to go forward in faith. Thank you. Does anybody have any questions? Any comments? Any responses?
I think I would answer that by saying you're looking at a long-term goal, not a short-term goal. I think there's not one of us here who can't relate to that. And we all should know more Scripture than we do. I find myself often sadly deficient in that area. Somebody will bring something up and you don't have it right at the tips of your fingers. And there are some people who do. And I think the thing that we have to do is continually steep ourselves in the Word. I know Reverend Beakey has often mentioned that sometimes it's more valuable for us to take several verses and contemplate them prayerfully, take them back to God every day, rather than to read through even, you know, a whole chapter, especially if you take something like Proverbs, which contains a tremendous amount of practical wisdom for everyday life. If you read a whole chapter in Proverbs, sometimes if there's 31 verses, there's 31 different subjects. If you try and go through them, you know, not much is going to stick, but if you take a few things and a few concepts at a time, when you're doing your planning, look at, okay, what are the obvious concepts here? What are some of the values that are evident? What are some of the, you know, try and relate it to something. You're not just trying to memorize, but you're trying to understand. What are some of the things that are happening here? And there's no quick solution for the question you're asking. You know, this is a long term and it's an ongoing thing. And yeah, it's afraid of that's an opportunity waiting for you. I don't know what your job is, but sometimes if you have opportunity in your day to listen to sermons or you know, lessons or you know, various things in a tape deck if you're driving or in a tractor that's got, I know some of these tractors today are pretty sophisticated, take opportunity to do that. If there are good Bible radio programs, sometimes there's some very simple, straightforward teaching, and not that we would agree with everything, but sometimes there are lessons that can be learned and that we'll make those mental connections between the Scripture and the principles that are being... Anything you can add to that, Pastor Neil? Okay, the question is, as a parent, he's giving up his children to the catechism teacher, and he wants to know what he can do to help that catechism teacher do their job. One thing, prayerful support behind the scenes is going to be crucial. The second thing I would do is ask your children what the lesson is about. Talk to them about it. Ask them to explain some simple things back to you. The other thing you can do is just touch base with the teacher once in a while about perhaps the behaviors of your children, if you have concerns about that. You know. Ask the teacher, does my child seem to understand? Or is my child involved in the lesson? And both of those things you can talk to your child about and try and reinforce. And that way, again, you're trying to reinforce the expectations. Maybe some of you can add to that as well. Absolutely. That's crucial. Never talk down about anything a teacher says. And that goes for a school teacher as well. You know, if something happens in school and you don't agree with it, don't let your child know. As soon as you do, you've got a child who can go back to school. And I've heard kids say this in class. Yeah, my dad's going to give him a call and tear his face off. Ouch. You know, and kids will do that. And it's a self-protection thing. And when they do that, all of a sudden, guess what happens to what's happening in the class? Yeah. No, it's absolutely crucial that the respect of the teacher and the integrity of the lesson and the purpose of catechism is made. Any other comments to that or to anything else? Okay, well, I hope this has been worthwhile for you. I hope it hasn't been overwhelming. But by the same token, I hope it still makes you uncomfortable. And to the point where it has to bring you again and again to recognize that if we try and do this on our own, we're in the wrong place. God is able and God is willing to hold us up, to direct us, because we're not doing all our work. And we're called to teach catechism. We're doing this.